Hello. Welcome to this week's edition of the Africa Climate Conversations, a weekly podcast bridging climate change communication gaps in Africa. My name is Sophie Mbogwa. Today on Building Momentum to COP26, we start the series by contextualizing current climate change negotiations by looking back to where it originated and how it has evolved. To walk us through this journey, I'm joined by a climate change policy and governance expert, James. Welcome to the show. Would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is James Murombetsi, and I am a climate policy and governance expert. I've been engaged with the climate policy process more or less since 1992, when the UNFCCC was inaugurated at the Rio Earth Summit. So I'm speaking in my personal capacity, although I also have other official sort of capacities here. But in that sense, let me say firstly sort of to retrace our steps to where we all started with the climate negotiations journey. Concerns with the climate change actually go back to the quite a long way. Although the scientific sort of analysis of the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on the climate system really began to influence policy, firstly with the reactions from the World Met Organizations, as well as the United Nations Environment Program, which resulted in the creation of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. At the same time, there were also concerns with what was happening with environmental change, in particular with the biodiversity loss, which resulted in the commissioning by the United Nations of a report which was produced by the former Norwegian Prime Minister, Gro Harlem. I think the report was titled Our Common Future, right?
Yeah.
So the impact of that report, Our Common Future, and the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change collectively led to the convening of the first World Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, so-called the Rio Earth Summit. So the Gro Harlem Brundtland report was launched at the 92 summit, which ultimately resulted in the creation of three United Nations conventions to respond to global environmental change and climate change. These were firstly the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, secondly the United Nations Convention on Desertification, and thirdly the Convention on Biological Diversity. Those three, the Convention on Biological Diversity and on Desertification, were actually binding from the outset, in the sense that the parties to those conventions agreed that they were prepared to take immediate action to try to start to respond to the impacts of human activity on environment, including the spread of desertification. So this saw, for instance, the creation of the CBD Secretariat, but also the United Nations Environment Program. On climate change, although the science was by that time already compelling, the political agreement on what to do about climate change was much more difficult to achieve. So what you had was a framework convention on climate change, a framework in the sense that the framework was created to guide further negotiations. So national governments became parties to the framework convention, but it did not have any binding agreements, treaties or actions, except that the nations then started working towards creating a framework mechanism which would allow for binding undertakings, including actions to limit human impact on the climate system. So this ultimately resulted in the finalization of the Kyoto Protocol, which came into force in 2009. It was agreed in 2007, came into force in 2009. The Kyoto Protocol was the first binding climate treaty And you know, the Kyoto Protocol created two mechanisms, Clean Development Mechanism, the UN RED, and the Joint Implementation Provision. But principally, Kyoto identified two sets of criteria for participation. The first was that it divided countries or parties into Annex 1 and Annex 2, or non-Annex 1 parties. Annex 1 parties, in terms of the UNFCCC convention, were those parties which had contributed more greenhouse gas to the historical concentrations of emissions in the atmosphere, while Annex 2 or non-Annex parties were those that were less responsible, but that were also less capable of responding to the impacts of already occurring climate change. So Kyoto put in place mechanisms by which Annex 1 countries were to firstly limit their emissions, and secondly, contribute to the efforts of non-Annex parties to adapt to climate change. It created carbon credits as one way of trading in carbon in order for member states to be able to manage their own carbon emissions. So carbon emitting countries were given limits, right? How much carbon they could actually emit into the atmosphere. But when they reached those limits, they also had the mechanisms through the Kyoto Protocol to trade in carbon credits with other countries that were not emitting to their limit, as it were. And then, of course, the benefits from carbon trading, but also from other mechanisms, were also made available to, for instance, the Global Adaptation Fund and other climate funds that were designed to support climate adaptation in non-Annex countries. Mm. So implementation of Kyoto started in 2009 and for an initial five-year period. Sorry, 2007 for an initial five-year period. So Kyoto was effectively phase one implemented until 2012. Mm-hmm. During this period, you had the operation of these different mechanisms, the Clean Development Mechanism, which was a carbon trading mechanism, the RED Plus mechanism, which was a carbon sequestration-based carbon trading mechanism, and the joint implementation, which created mechanisms by which different member states could actually jointly implement their climate actions. Mm-hmm. When Kyoto came to an end in 2012, there was no immediate agreement on how to proceed into a follow-up treaty. For the principal reason that between 2007 and 2012, it became clear that developing nations, or some developing nations, were beginning to emit more carbon dioxide, more greenhouse gases than Annex 1 parties to the convention. So this was a recognition of the fast rates of growth of economies such as Brazil, China, India, Russia. But also the growth of those economies was also based on increased consumption of hydrocarbons, coal, diesel, and also increased trade, which meant that they were also contributing more to aviation and shipping and transportation emissions generally. Mm-hmm. So this created a context where you could no longer sustain the division between Annex and non-Annex parties because of the growing emissions from some non-Annex parties. And so there was an increased desire to ensure that all parties to the convention contributed in terms of climate actions to the achievement of the objectives of the convention, which were still to limit dangerous interference with the global climate system. Mm. So from 2012 until 2015, you had a process of negotiation within the context of the UNFCCC to design a post-Kyoto climate governance framework. And the result of these negotiations was the Paris Agreement, which was reached in 2015 at COP21, whose intention and design was to be inclusive so that all parties would contribute climate actions towards the global effort, and that mechanisms would also be put in place through the Paris Agreement for those contributions to be equitable, that is to reflect the individual capacities and circumstances of different countries, and also to make provision for creation of global funds to support enhanced climate action, and also to operationalize the commitment of mobilizing $100 billion a year, which was made first in Copenhagen. So the agreement in Paris was secondly to reconfirm that developed countries would mobilize $100 billion a year by 2020 to support climate actions in developing countries. Secondly, that all countries would, by 2020, we have submitted nationally determined contributions, which are the actions that each individual party to the convention would put in place to contribute towards mitigating greenhouse gas emissions, but also to adapting to climate change. So that was for the 5 years between 2015 and 2020, parties to the Paris Agreement would start working on finalizing their NDCs, mobilizing the resources and ensuring that the Paris Agreement was in fact ready for implementation in 2020. So this is a very sort of a broad overview of where we came from and why we have transitioned from Kyoto to the Paris Agreement and where we are at right now. So COP26 is effectively the COP that was supposed to take place in 2020.
Yeah.
It is very significant in the sense that it is that COP which is going to firstly bring together a comprehensive review of all of the NDCs of all of the parties together.
Yeah.
But it's also the COP at which parties are expected to have updated their nationally determined contributions to reflect there is required effort or ambition, to use the language of the Paris Agreement, ambition to keep us within 2 degrees warming and if possible to achieve 1.5 degrees warming. Secondly, it is also the COP that is going to confirm whether the $100 billion a year can be mobilized and distributed equitably and transparently and fairly to all of the different needs of the members and parties to the agreement. Thirdly, it is also the COP that is designed to put in place the rules of engagement, so to speak, the rules to guide the implementation of the Paris Agreement. These were supposed to have been agreed already at COP24, then COP25, but this did not happen because there were still some outstanding issues to be resolved. There is no guarantee that these are going to be resolved in COP26, although a lot of progress has been made towards that objective, although there are still a few issues to be negotiated in the text. So this is a very crucial COP that we are coming to in terms of operationalizing the agreement. In terms of the NDCs, we know from evaluations that have been undertaken by UNEP, for instance, or the Global Adaptation Movement, that we are still far off the 2 degrees target. Mm-hmm. In fact, the aggregated impact of all of the NDCs is putting us on a very optimistically on a path to 2.7, almost 3 degrees warming. That is in the most optimistic scenario, and possibly more than 3 degrees warming in the less optimistic scenarios. So COP26 is going to be very significant in the sense that it is going to find mechanisms of ensuring that we can get the NDCs back to put us back on track for achieving 2 degrees and hopefully to work towards 1.5 degrees. And then thirdly, COP26 is very important in the sense that beyond just mobilizing the $100 billion a year from public and private funds, it is also going to finalize the mechanisms the mechanisms for operationalizing Article 6 of the agreement, which is about how, for instance, resources are going to be mobilized from market and non-market sources. Mm-hmm. So for those three reasons, the COP26 is really, really a significant COP.
Absolutely.
Right.
Go ahead.
Now, an additional concern for us as Africa is that since 2019, the World Met Organization and other UN agencies, including the UN Economic Commission for Africa. They've been publishing the State of Climate Change in Africa report, which actually is focused on what is happening as a result of climate change in Africa itself. The 2020 report actually concludes that because there are, in fact, regional variations in warming, Africa is warming at a faster rate and higher than all of the other regions. And by 2020, the WMO report concludes that Africa had warmed by about 1.8 degrees. Yeah. Celsius, while the rest of the global system had warmed by about 0.8 to 1 degree or 1.2 degrees Celsius. The report also concludes that the possibility of the weather system in Africa warming by more than 1.5 degrees in any 1 year is significantly higher than elsewhere in the world. So we are faced with a situation where the continent is going to COP26 knowing that we have warmed already more than all the other continents, but also that we have probably exceeded the 1.5 degrees that the Paris Agreement is aiming for. And therefore, for Africa, it is going to be significantly important to ensure that the global climate ambition is increased and increased immediately to ensure that we do not, in fact, endanger the climate system further, which would put us on a path that would exceed 2 degrees warming. Mm-hmm. Because we know that at 1.5, 1.8 degrees warming, the impacts on Africa have been devastating already in terms of extreme weather events. So we have extreme flooding, extreme droughts across the continent. We have temperature extremes, and all of those are impacting our economies in very profound ways. Mm-hmm. And so it is very urgent for Africa that COP26 be successful in terms of not just mobilizing resources, but also in ensuring that the ambition of the NDCs is increased and increased immediately. So that is the broad overview of where we are, how we got there, and why it's important for a successful COP26.
Mm. Thank you so much, James. I'm just listening to you speak, and I'm a couple of questions actually through my mind. And one of the things that we know currently, Africa has actually warmed 1.8 degrees already beyond what the Paris Agreement aimed to achieve. But I'm looking back at the Kyoto Protocol, and already the Paris Agreement kind of, you explained very well in terms of what happened and some of the developing countries which were in Annex II. Under the Kyoto Protocol already were beginning to actually develop and stuff like that, and also use other fossil fuels that contribute more to emissions. But I'm looking at the majority of African countries, and apart from South Africa and different and a few other countries, we have a lot of African countries that actually are in the UN system. You'll find them under the least developed countries. And when I look at what the Paris Agreement has, the moving forward is that NDCs, does it have everybody, like put everybody in terms of the differentiation that was actually there between the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement? Now we all, every country needs to submit to the UNFCCC their plan in terms of this is how we're going to actually go carbon neutral, carbon zero, I mean net zero by 2030 or by 2050. But then when you go back to the Kyoto Protocol and the convention itself, these it was very, very specific, and in terms of the common responsibilities that Annex 1 and Annex 2 countries had. And it was very clear there was the term common but differentiated responsibilities, and there was specific what the responsibilities that developed countries had. They were responsible in terms of the historical responsibility contribution to what the warming that we've had. Does it mean when you look, already Africa has warmed, but African continent itself, South Africa included, we contribute less than 4% of the global emissions. With consideration that we are the continent that will be much developing in the future, and so of course we need to develop in a low carbon way. But then, do you find that does NDCs put us all share that responsibility of emissions reduction? Does it ignore, or what exactly is your take in terms of the historical responsibilities that developed countries had and still have in terms of emissions, and the fact that now we have to all of us commit in terms of even the smallest of countries in Africa, small island states, say we are going to go, this is how much we're going to reduce our emissions despite the historical responsibilities.
Yeah, very, very important questions there. Firstly, you are absolutely right. Africa contributes less than 4% of our global emissions currently. And historically, it has actually been much, much less. And you're also correct that of the 4%, probably more than 50% comes from a very few countries, South Africa, Egypt, to some extent Nigeria. So the bulk of the rest of the African continent, you have net emissions of less than 1%. So for instance, in my country, Zimbabwe, I think the emissions about 0.04% or something like that. Mm-hmm. Possibly many African countries are in fact net positive already, in the sense that they absorb more carbon than they emit. So you would have countries like the countries in the Congo Basin or other sort of forested countries around Gabon, the Equatorial Guinea, Guinean forest system extending through Cameroon, Liberia, into parts of Cote d'Ivoire and so on. Mm-hmm. So in these places, you could actually, I think, see that there is significantly more carbon sequestration than there is carbon emissions. Now, so that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that Africa is 17% of the global population. Mm-hmm. So if you have 17% of the global population emitting less than 3%, less than 4% of global emissions, it already means that there is an inequitable distribution in terms of what has actually happened to carbon concentrations in the atmosphere. And we also know that the bulk of the emissions are from energy, for production, industrial production, energy for heating, energy for transportation, and so on. So you could say that development has been driven largely by the consumption of fossil fuels, so that those countries which have consumed more fossil fuels, they've also been able to develop more and faster than those countries which have consumed less fossil fuels. So you're absolutely correct on those counts. Now you bring into focus the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities in accordance with the national and capabilities. This is a principle, a core principle of the UNFCCC, the convention. It is also a core principle of the Kyoto Protocol, and it was the basis on which, in fact, the Kyoto Protocol divided countries into annex and non-annex. However, that principle is not, in fact, the principle which guides the NDCs, although it is still recognized in the Paris Agreement. Mm-hmm. The Paris Agreement mechanisms are not based on the principle of CBDR. So herein lies a problem. Where all countries are expected to contribute equally to climate actions, although still recognizing their own national circumstances and responsibilities. So a lot of the NDCs of, and you are correct to say that the bulk of African countries, I think 32 or 34 of the least developed countries are in Africa. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, also means that Africa is not developed much because it has not used its carbon resources or anyone else's carbon resources for that matter. Mm. So now the question is that a lot of the NDCs of African countries are dependent for their implementation on the availability of resources, conditional resources, that is resources from other parties to the convention. That's the one characteristic. A second characteristic of African NDCs is that a lot of them are focused on adaptation rather than on mitigation, because there's very little to mitigate. Although, in fact, you're also correct that African countries are looking at avoiding carbon emissions in their development trajectory. So African countries are looking to contribute towards global climate action by putting in place NDCs, but we cannot implement those NDCs unless resources are made available. Secondly, African countries are also looking to ensure that their climate actions are focused principally on assisting them to adapt to already occurring impacts of climate change, And thirdly, their climate actions are designed in ways that would allow them to embark on low emissions development trajectories. There are many issues associated with all of those three concerns that you raised. But I think these concerns are summarized, or rather are contained, contextualized in an ongoing debate that is focusing on what would constitute a just transition for Africa. What exactly would be climate justice for Africa? Answering the question that we have not really been responsible for this problem. However, we cannot compound the problem by adding unreasonably to emissions, to greenhouse gas emissions, while at the same time achieving our development objectives. Now, my understanding of where the just transition discussion is going is that I think the dominant opinion is that Africa has a right to develop.
Sure.
The continent is not going to be able to meet any of its sustainable development goals if it does not resolve, first and foremost, the energy crisis. So more than 50% of our population has no access to energy, and the continent needs to industrialize it. So all of this requires that we increase our consumption of energy. And there are two pathways towards this. The one is you'd expect that, of course, the most green way would be for us to consume renewable energy, of which the continent is very well endowed with sun, with wind, in some instances with a geothermal and so on, and also with hydro. The second is we can, in fact, actually use some of the carbon resources that are underutilized and that are still being discovered on the continent. So we have many discoveries of hydrocarbon deposits, oil and gas, but also coal. So this is a very complex, how do you resolve between the two? And I think the African position is that Africa could actually negotiate for space to use particularly its natural gas deposits. And the evidence exists to show that if the continent fully exploited existing natural gas deposits, this would increase its contribution to greenhouse gas concentrations by only 0.6%. 0.6% is probably insignificant given that the continent already contributes only 4%. That would mean increasing the contribution to 4.6%, still under 5% of global emissions. So if the continent were allowed to increase its emissions and peak, say, by 2050 or thereabouts, at 0.6% increase, and then start to decline as green and renewable technologies become more viable, this would not have any significant detrimental impacts on the global climate system. But however, this would need to happen in such a way, at a time when the high emitting countries are also significantly reducing their own emissions, in order to not only compensate for that 0.6% increase in Africa, but also to ensure that the concentrations in the atmosphere are not compounded by their continuing actions. For us, therefore, climate justice means, firstly, development, that the climate system should not, in fact, be an impediment to the development of the continent. It already is becoming an impediment to the development of the continent in terms of the costs of adaptation that the continent is carrying, in terms of the impacts of climate change on the continent's ecosystems, livelihoods, infrastructure, and so on. The continent did not cause this. So we want the rest of the world to pay or to contribute towards assisting the continent to adapt to climate change, ensuring that climate impacts are not a hindrance to our developmental trajectory. And secondly, also that our own actions contribute to our ability to achieve our sustainable development goals, but also that those development actions do not significantly contribute to carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. That is the climate justice debate in Africa. And that is also going to be part of the discussion at COP26. How does the continent achieve net zero in conjunction with all of the other continents? What kind of settlement is to be reached, and what kind of assistance is available to the continent?
Absolutely. And James, we cannot adapt, we cannot mitigate, we cannot achieve justice, basically. And even we cannot do anything without provision of funds. finance is critical. It's actually what enables capacities to be built. It's what enables technologies to be availed and stuff like that. And when you look at the convention, it was very clear what responsibilities Annex I countries had. And I'm wondering, in terms of the mechanism by which, under the Kyoto Protocol, how finance was actually provided and moving forward. And we've been having this whole issues of 100 billion mobilizing. And wondering, in terms of probably the language, and because we've been having push and pull in terms of provisions of this finance, but it's very clear that developed countries pledge to mobilize $100 billion annually by 2020. Should we probably look into the wording and the language from mobilizing to probably provision moving forward?
Yes. Yeah. So you are correct as well. I think this is part of the debate now, that mobilizing is quite misleading. And it does not clearly identify what exactly should be done by who. Secondly, mobilizing implies defining finance in very loose ways than, for instance, in provisioning. So provisioning would actually entail agreeing on what exactly constitutes climate finance, putting in place transparency mechanisms to ensure that climate finance is not counted with other finance, for instance, with existing obligations for development assistance, obligations for disaster relief, and whatever else obligations contained in different conventions and mechanisms. So provisioning, I think, is what is being proposed. But even that, I think, in my mind, still means that we need to be a little bit more precise in terms of what exactly we are measuring. And that means that perhaps we should also not be de-linking the discussions of climate finance from the discussions of the Warsaw Mechanism on loss and damage.
Yeah.
So you have, firstly, provisioning that is made because it is, in fact, the agreement in terms of the convention. But secondly, we also need to provide compensation for loss and damage, particularly as you have significant improvements in attribution science, right? So now we can attribute some events at least to the impacts of our climate change. And if we can do that, we should also be able to attribute the cost of those impacts to the emitters, and they should be able to pay or compensate countries that are experiencing impacts, in addition to also providing climate finance. So it's a very important debate. I don't know how it is going to pan out, but this is also going to be one of the discussions in terms of the Article 6 of the Paris Agreement.
Yeah. Then again, we're dealing with two crises here. We have the recovery in terms of the COVID-19. And of course, we have climate issues that have actually also been impacting. We've seen them impacting rich nations. We've seen Germany, we've seen different countries flooding and everything and stuff like that. And one of the beautiful things that I've actually seen is that COVID-19 has proved that there are resources when nations want to mobilize those resources and provide those resources, basically. But climate finance in general has not been really forthcoming. How do we move forward? Because then again, now we have NDCs. African nations says they need about $3 trillion dollars to implement their NDCs, because 80% of that is conditional. But then again, we have, you know, loss and damage every year. You look at Mozambique and the losses that we saw the country undergo and the amount of money that the country needed to actually rebuild. Look at what has been happening in South Africa in terms of water. Look at what is actually happening also in Madagascar in terms of the drought. How do we mobilize finance in terms, at the moment, looking into the COVID-19 pandemic that is also affecting developed countries, probably much more than it's affecting the African countries?
Yeah, so this is another major dynamic which is going to be contextualizing the COP26 discussions. What exactly is possible now in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic? So for Africa, for the first time in what, 3 decades, African economies in recession because of reduced economic activity due to the pandemic. This also, the impacts of the pandemic on developed economies reduces their ability to provision or to mobilize the resources for climate change. Mm. So what exactly can be done? We know that African economies have already been significantly impacted by climate change in different ways. Mm-hmm. African countries are now contributing between 3% and 15% of their own GDP towards climate adaptation, adapting to climate change events that are not even budgeted for. Now, this is a very, very big. And this is happening with resources that would have gone to other sectors of the economy, for instance, to investment in social services, to investment in infrastructure and so on. So you have massive losses that are happening already. At the same time, you also need to contribute towards implementing the NDCs. Even if the proportion of the NDCs that is unconditional is small, 10 to 20% of the NDCs in most instances. So it's a real challenge, I think, and there are new mechanisms, innovative mechanisms that African countries are developing. Mm-hmm. We have some small island states led by Seychelles, which have been developing blue and green bonds, which have also been negotiating debt swaps for climate change, where their national debt, their sovereign debt is converted into a credit for climate actions. You also have countries like Nigeria, which have also launched green bonds, which are effectively a mechanism to try and mobilize private finance, private investment in based solutions in order to contribute towards mobilizing sufficient resources for climate actions. Mm. You also have many countries that are putting in place policy and legislative instruments to remove barriers to trade in green technologies. So for instance, removing tariff and non-tariff barriers to the movement of photovoltaic cells, panels for solar systems, removing customs tariffs on new technologies that are more energy efficient, increasing investments in hydro power generation and so on. So there are quite a number of innovations that are being promoted at a national level through policy and legal mechanisms. And I think also African countries are beginning to create spaces for innovation by supporting science, investments in science and technology research locally in order to accelerate local contributions towards renewable technologies. So a lot is happening. In my mind, I don't think that this is sufficient given the scale of the problem. So for instance, I think that while green and blue bonds are very innovative mechanisms, I really think that if African countries have demonstrated that they are willing to renegotiate their debt, then developed countries should also be willing to cancel the debts, particularly of the LDCs, in return for those countries investing in the cancelled debt, for instance, in renewable technologies.
Yeah.
On the trade frontier, I think that the African countries should explore more the possibility of using the continental free trade area to improve intra-African trade in goods and services. And that would possibly include trade in natural gas in order to ensure that we have a much faster energy transition on the continent, but also in order to reduce dependence on external resources for our own internal economic development. Mm-hmm. So a lot still needs to be done in terms of innovation on the financial side and also in terms of renegotiating the long-term relationship between the continent and everyone else.
James, before I let you go, I think it would be nice to just, you know, give us a snippet of how Africa negotiates, because then again, when we go to COP26, how will Africa be negotiating? Does Africa negotiate as a country, or does Africa negotiate individual countries, or does Africa negotiate together as a bloc? And who funds African negotiating process?
So yeah, that's another set of complex questions that we have to, I think, clarify as well.
Yeah.
There is a There's quite a lot that is happening in the negotiations. The first is that we do, in fact, have an Africa group of negotiators, which actually brings together UNFCCC focal point persons from all of the African member states, and further sort of divides them into negotiating streams. So you have focal point persons that are negotiating adaptation, some finance, others mitigation, gender, all of the different negotiating streams. So this is a group of technical negotiators which attempts to ensure a technical engagement with the negotiation process. However, Africa still, or member African countries negotiate and participate in the UNFCCC as individual sovereign states. There is no country that is voting on behalf of the rest of the countries, and there is certainly no mechanism that exists for that kind of a collective voice at the technical level. At the political level, you have the Africa, the Committee of African Heads of State on Climate Change, CAOSC, which is also advised by the Africa Ministerial Conference on Environment. So those two together attempt to bring some unity to the political voice so that you actually have a common political negotiating position. And I think a significant progress has been made towards ensuring that level of commonality. But at the end of the day, we're still negotiating as individual countries, and there are several levels of complexity to those relationships, which I think require some time to actually go through the nuances. Suffice to say that we have a different arrangement, for instance, in the European Union, where the EU is a party to the UNFCCC. And whichever country is chairing the EU represents the European Union in the climate negotiations as well. This is not to say that Africa should follow a similar arrangement, simply just to point out that it is in fact possible to have a different arrangement that would ensure a more synchronized negotiating position between the African countries. So let me stop there. I think we really would need to schedule a whole session to discuss the African common positions, how the technical common positions are put together by the group of negotiators, but also what are some of the gaps in the process and how can they be addressed.
Yeah, exactly. Probably also discuss the funding, because it's also multi-pronged.
And funding as well, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Super. So those are important nuances, yeah.
So we're going to have this series running throughout the October and November, and I'm sure we will find some other time to actually discuss these nuances.
Sure, thank you.
Absolutely. But your final word, Jeff.
Well, there's still a lot to discuss. COP26 is going to be very, very important, and I think that everyone needs to be fully informed of what the issues are, and everyone needs to get the space to contribute towards the African positions. I think that the climate change is too important to be left to a small group of people. Certainly, the negotiations are highly technical and specialized, but climate change itself has got impacts that are very broad and generalized. And so we all need to have the access to the same information and be able to interpret that information in order to inform the outcomes of COP26. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, James, for finding time.
Thank you very much. We'll talk again.
All right, super. Thank you.
That was James Murombetsi, a climate change policy and governance expert, talking to us on the history of climate change negotiations and the events that will shape discussions at COP26. Next week, we ask how the change from the Kyoto Protocol to the Paris Agreement affected how Africa was recognized and what African negotiators are doing about it. Please make a date with me. But in the meantime, please send me your contributions to info@AfricaClimateConversations or through Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or leave us a comment on our website, www.AfricaClimateConversations.com. We are on socials as Africa Climate Conversations. I hope to see you on Tuesday. For now, kwaheri. My name is Sophie Mbogo.